You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Alex Tokuungawa, no mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Ratu Tuesday. I'm your host Alex and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in studio by producer Liam. E whai ake nei coming up on the show. For Desk Science this week, our expert, Professor Alan Blackman, speaks with us about electricity from ambient moisture, bananas and smoothies, and whether or not we can cool the earth with tiny particles. For our weekly catch-up with the National Party, I spoke with National MP Ryan Hamilton about the government's increasing use of AI, the Legislation Definitions of Woman and a Man Amendment Bill, and the government changing agency names to English before Māori. Liam, what do you have for us today?
Hi Alex. For Green World this week, producer Thomas spoke to the University of Waikato's Law Associate Professor Nathan Cooper on New Zealand's role in the United Nations' latest resolution affirming the International Court of Justice's ruling that states have a legal duty to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and protect the environment from the climate crisis.
Kia ora o whakaaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch, tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395 or wai mai rāne, give us a call in studio on 309 3879. Ko wā e ware ware e ahe ana koutou te whakarongo ke ēnei kōrero ano hei pakehere roki roki mā runga i te pai, tuku tuku o irirangi poho me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Kia timata te whakaturanga, let's get into the show.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
For Dear Science this today, we're joined by our expert, Professor Alan Blackman. Welcome.
don't say that word, goodness. especially after last week or the week before.
Can't trust experts.
Keep well away from them.
What has science got for us today?
Well, okay, so here's a question. How do we make energy? Because that is kind of important, isn't it? So, you know, the major ways that we make energy at the moment are, you know, like burning things. So you will burn fuel and then that will power a motor of some description and everything, and then you can do work and all that sort of stuff. Moving water, so letting water go through a turbine and everything, spinning a turbine, all of those sorts of things. Getting two metals with potential difference and then you link them with a wire and you get flow of electrons and blah, 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 blah. So, you know, that's how we make energy. But one of the ways that you wouldn't think of making energy is just by using ambient moisture in the air. You wouldn't think that would really go a long way, would you?
No, can't quite track that off the top of my head.
No, me neither. So how they got this idea, I have no idea, but there's some workers in the UK and Italy who have just published a paper in the journal Nano Energy, and what they have managed to make is a biodegradable, and that's really by the by in this case, because that's not the most impressive thing about it, biodegradable moisture energy generator, or otherwise known as a MEG, apparently. Okay. Wow. A moisture energy generator. And they make this from things as simple as gelatin, okay, sodium chloride or table salt, and activated carbon, or basically charcoal. That's it.
Not a set of super rare.
No rare earths in there whatsoever. And this mixture somehow generates electricity using humidity in the air, which is quite remarkable. So how the heck does this work? Well, as much as I can understand it, and I'm no expert, so what they do is that they mix these three components in water and then they dry the whole thing out, okay? And it goes from this nice mixture where it's all sort of, everything's sort of nicely mixed, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. However, when you dry this out, it undergoes a process called self-stratification, which in other words means that it orders itself into layers, okay? So it goes from this mixed state into sort of this stratified state, this layered state. And one of the layers is what we call hydrophilic. It means it likes water. And another layer is hydrophobic, okay, which means it hates water. And so essentially one side of the material likes water, the other side of the material hates water, and the bit in the middle is sort of easy-ozy sort of thing. And what this appears to do is that it can then absorb moisture from the air. So you expose it to humidity, and then as soon as you do that, what that then allows is movement of ions. So ions are anything that's got a charge. Mm. So we've got table salt in there, okay? Table salt is made of ions. It's made up of positively charged sodium ions and negatively charged chloride ions, okay? And if you can allow these to move, then what can happen is that you can induce movement of electrons, okay? And as you hopefully know, movement of electrons is basically an electric current, yeah. Okay? So if you've got these positive ions that are moving, then they have to be balanced somehow, okay? And they can be balanced by the movement of electrons. So the movement of positive charge away can be balanced by the movement of electrons in the opposite direction. And there you have yourself a little electrical circuit, essentially, and a flow of electrons. So you get electric current. And so they've been playing around with this. As I say, they've just published it. And they can get a potential difference of 1 volt, which, you know, it doesn't sound like very much, but hell, you know, considering what they're using.
Yeah, from three things that you could find in an aisle yep. at a supermarket.
Yep, basically. And so they can maintain that potential difference of a volt for around about 30 days, they say. So, you know, this stuff is fairly robust. And what you can then do, like anything, you can connect them in series and then the voltage increases. Okay, when you connect things in series. So they can get up to about 90 volts wow. potential difference and 5 milliamps current. And that is enough to power things like small LEDs and stuff like that, a string of LEDs and stuff. So this just sort of boggles the mind, really, that you can take such simple ingredients and just mix them up, and then all of a sudden all that it's doing is absorbing moisture from the air and generating an electric current. What the hell?
Yeah, it's like it's one of those things that, like, going back to my casting my mind back to high school chemistry classes, right, where I'm like, yeah, I guess that works, but it's still like, how did we get here?
Yeah. And that's the thing, you know, how they managed to sort of come up with that particular combination of things. Obviously, there's a lot of thought gone into it. It's not just some random something. But, you know, it really is quite remarkable that I remember talking on the show, oh, gosh, I don't know, 2 or 3 years ago now, about a similar sort of thing where you could generate electricity from water going down very, very narrow tubes.
Oh.
And a similar sort of thing. So there's all... excuse the pun, potential sources of energy out there that, you know, maybe we just haven't even thought about yet, haven't even contemplated because it sounds too bizarre. Mm. But, you know, this goes to show that maybe, you know, nothing is too bizarre. So, you know, watch the space on this one. This is quite incredible.
Fun time.
Yeah.
What else do you have for us today?
Bananas.
I don't like bananas.
What?
That's my
wow.
brave take.
Goodness me.
No.
Wow.
Never been a banana guy.
Wow. Okay. I'm. You've got to be the first, I think. Everyone likes bananas except Alex. There we go. Liam, you're bananas?
Oh, yeah, of course. Oh,
there we go. Yeah, there we go. Yes.
Bananas.
Yes. So we all know that bananas are natural and that they're really good for you and that they are, you know, an absolutely vital ingredient in your smoothies, aren't they? They absolutely are. Nothing
can't have a smoothie without them.
Nothing like a good banana smoothie, okay? And so that was sort of the received wisdom, I guess. And so some folk in the States decided to, as you do, test such things. Never assume. And they found some very interesting results, let's say. So we need to delve into a little bit of chemistry to discuss this. So we're going to talk about molecules called flavonoids. flavonoids, okay? So they are linked to good health. They are good molecules. We want as many of those as we can get. So they're linked to heart health. They're linked to cognitive health. They're just good for you, okay? And so you want to be chowing down on anything that contains these, okay? So in other words, apples, pears, blueberries, blackberries, grapes, those sorts of things, okay? Just the sort of things that you might find yourself throwing in a bit of a smoothie, maybe, okay? So that's all good. So if you make your smoothie out of those, then you're going to be getting a good dose of flavonoids. However, don't be too tempted to chuck in a banana on top of them, okay? Oh. Because bananas contain an enzyme, and an enzyme is just a big molecule that carries out a particular process very, very specifically, and it's called polyphenol oxidase, okay? And the thing about enzymes, the names sort of do what they say on the tin. So this oxidizes polyphenols, okay? Polyphenol oxidizes molecules called polyphenols. What are polyphenols? Well, they are, well, the enzyme comes into action like when you bruise a fruit or something like that and it goes brown. That's your polyphenol oxidase in work, okay, in operation. And so this enzyme goes for these polyphenol molecules. Now, flavonoids just happen to be a subclass of polyphenols, okay? So what these workers did, they said, okay, well, you know, these bananas, they've got this enzyme that might sort of undo all the good flavonoids that are in your smoothie if you go and throw bananas in with your smoothie on top of your apples and your grapes and blah, 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 blah. So what they did, say they monitored flavonol levels from a bunch of volunteers in blood and urine after consuming either a banana smoothie or a berry smoothie, as well as a flavonoid capsule, a flavonol capsule, okay? So they're taking their flavonols, following it down with either a banana smoothie or the berry smoothie, and then measuring the flavonol levels in your blood and your urine. And what they found was that after your banana smoothie, those that had the banana smoothie and then the flavonol, 84% lower amount of flavonol compared with if you just had your berry smoothie by itself. Okay,
which isn't an insignificant.
That's not an insignificant. Yeah. Okay, so it looks like throwing in a banana into a berry smoothie is sort of undoing a lot of the good that the berry smoothie was going to do you. Which is not to say, for goodness' sake, don't eat bananas like Alex. Otherwise, you end up like Alex. You know, so you know, bananas are good for you. They are absolutely, definitely, definitely good for you. But maybe might be best not to mix them with those sort of berry-type fruits, those high flavonol fruits.
Okay? Have a banana after your smoothie.
yeah, basically, okay? So I think that's a very, very interesting finding, yeah. But I'm not trying to dissuade people from eating bananas. But fascinating stuff. So it goes to show that, you know, mixing foods and stuff like that, you do have interactions between the molecules in different foods.
There's chemistry going on, right?
Oh, hell yeah. Oh, there's chemistry going on everywhere.
Well,
Alex.
Like, obviously,
goodness.
But I mean, like, it's just, of course, things happen.
It's ubiquitous. It's totally ubiquitous. But I think that's a very, very interesting finding. And I think the mainstream media are going to pick that up, I think, because it's a good story.
It is. So. It's nice and relatable.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, interesting stuff.
And what do you have for us last?
Oh, sheesh. Well, controversial. Controversial. Okay. Solar geoengineering. Now, I don't. You two are too young to remember the great days of the original Simpsons in the 90s.
Yes.
So,
and when Mr. Burns shut out the sun on Springfield. No, you don't remember.
No, I wasn't allowed to watch Simpsons.
You've
as
got
a kid.
So much to look forward to. The 90s Simpsons. the first 10 seasons are just brilliant. So solar geoengineering, right, we all know that we are living on a warming planet and it's probably not the best. And so what can we do to stop that warming? God forbid that we stop using fossil fuels or anything like that.
Of course, that would be ridiculous.
That would be ridiculous. So why don't we then just try and block the sun out? You know, there's a better idea, isn't it? Okay. So there is an Israeli company called Stardust Solutions who are proposing this. And they have got 75 million seed funding, and they've got a patent application and stuff. They've been doing lab tests, and what they are looking at is a mixture of amorphous silica, which is basically sand, pretty much, same sort of thing, and calcium carbonate, which is basically eggshells. And so their plan is to crush this up really, really, really finely into a very, very fine sort of dust and everything, and then you release it in the upper atmosphere. Okay, and then this will actually reflect back a certain amount of solar radiation. Okay, you're both sort of giving me the same the same face there.
It seems like a really roundabout way of just putting mirrors at the sky.
Yeah, so let's talk ethics here, because, you know, who thinks this is a great idea? I mean, this is just tinkering around with the most precious resource that we've got, which is basically, you know, our atmosphere. Mm-hmm. And you want to get stuck into that, and you could precipitate uncontrolled change in the weather patterns or whatever. Nobody knows. Nobody has the slightest idea what this would do, whether it would be good, whether it would be terrible. And I'm not sure we should even be looking at this. I mean, there are plenty of mitigating factors that we could utilize, and this would be, in my view, a very, very, very last resort. But
yeah, it feels like focusing on how can we make the sun hit less is maybe a couple steps down of how can we make it so the atmosphere that we have is not.
There we go. They're out of the mouths of babes. There we go. Honestly, you know.
Yeah, it's just, oh god.
So, but again, having said that, we've kind of been doing the same thing incrementally for years. We've been pumping stuff into the atmosphere and pumping and pumping, and that's why we've had the warming. You know, that's why things are not looking so great. So. We can't be too smug about this, possibly, but I'm not sure that this is the actual best solution. I think there are plenty of other things that we could and should be doing way, way before even contemplating anything like this. It's, you know, it's an experiment on the Earth. Mm-hmm. It's an experiment on humanity, essentially, and I don't think we're quite ready for that yet. I don't think things have got that bad yet.
Yeah, feels like a little bit of a... Maybe the wrong thing to be looking at right now.
Yeah. I think that's a reasonable way of saying it. Yes. So, again, it'll be interesting to see how far they get with this. I mean, 75 million sounds like a lot in seed funding, but really, in terms of science, it's, you know, dare I say it, a drop in the bucket. So, it will be interesting to see how this goes, because, you know, ordinarily, something like this is sort of confined to a single country, you know. But this is not. This is going to be the entire planet. This is a global experiment. And who's in charge of the global experiments? Who makes the ethical, decisions for global experiments? There's a question to finish on. Yeah.
Nice and existential for the end of our segment. Well,
indeed.
Thanks, Alan, for joining us. Thank you, Motet, and thank you, Science. Motet After Dark, enjoy Beats, Eats, and Collection Treats after hours, 4th to 6th of June. Book now at motet.nz.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to Motet, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
We'll be right back.
Wow, we get along so well. I feel like I've known you my whole life.
I know, it's crazy. I'd love to see you again.
Sorry, I just have to ask. Your hoodie is so random. What is 95BFM?
Oh, I knew this was too good to be true.
What? Wait, where are you going?
No!
Show the world exactly who you are with our range of classic 95BFM merch. From the BSA slogan t-shirt to ringer tees and hoodies, get yours now at twotonesmerch.co.nz.
Maynard Larkin is shaking things up with his fantastic alt-country debut album, Rattlesnake Boy. And we've made it our album of the week. Not much in the tank, so I'm driving slow. That means we have copies of the vinyl to give away to B-card holders. Just stay tuned to breakfast all week for your cue to enter. Rattlesnake Boy, the new album from Maynard Larkin. Available now wherever good music is found.
At this radio station, we do our utmost to abide by the Broadcasting Standards Authority and their rules and guidelines. If you seriously think we've crossed the line on air, give us a call on 309 4831 within 20 working days of the broadcast date and tell us about it. We'll be able to help you out and tell you the procedure if you wish to make a formal complaint to the Broadcasting Standards Authority. Fuck knuckles, cock and piss. Balls. Thank you.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with National MP Ryan Hamilton.
Last week, the government announced that it would intensify AI usage in the public sector in a move to further reduce spending in the sector. The government has defended the move, but concerns have been raised about the safety, regulation, and vulnerability of AI services. Last week also saw the legislation, Definitions of Woman and Man, Amendment Bill pass its first reading. The members' bill would seek to, in New Zealand law, define genders in a move that has been criticised by many as transphobic. Last week also saw the change of government agencies' names to give primacy to their English names rather than Te Reo Māori first. This week, I spoke with National MP Ryan Hamilton about these topics. Last week, the government announced plans to increase AI usage by the government. What are these plans and why has the government settled on them?
Well, obviously, you know, there's been a lot of criticism of, you know, in the last sort of six to nine years, particularly before us, around the increase in the size of the public service. And we came in 23, largely as a as a national party, but also as part of the coalition on making sure that that it was fit for purpose. And we've gone about making some changes, I guess marginal changes, where we've redirected some of that back room office and redeployed it back into the front lines, which is really important around teaching, nursing, police. But I guess this is really a bit more of a bolder step and say, okay, this is sort of, that was the first phase. Now we're going to look at some more meaningful impact. And I guess it's correlated with AI. I mean, even AI in the last 2 years, I think, you know, I'm sure you've experienced yourself just the accessibility to it, the ease and usability of it. It's just such a dynamic space in terms of growth and application. So obviously it makes sense if we can streamline, you know, what is such a massive part of our workforce. There's going to be some efficiencies in that, not only in terms of productivity, but also cost savings, which, you know, when the taxpayers funding them is critical.
Looking at these moves, especially, as you've said, in the wake of other job cuts made by the national government in the public sector, where does the government expect this to kind of leave New Zealand and its economy on top of that?
Well, I think we've always taken a pragmatic approach to it. Like, we knew if we came in hard in 23, you know, with more of an austerity type of a budget, it could have had much greater, you know, implications, because at that stage, inflation was rampant. Our debt levels, you know, were high. And in fact, we had a lot of fiscal cliffs and holes that we weren't sort of aware of until we were able to actually see where, you know, funding stream, time-limited funding streams had stopped and where they started. So it took us a while to manage that. So we took a, you know, we didn't make radical changes. And even what we're proposing now isn't radical. It's about how do we improve the efficiency of the public service, which a lot of that, there'll be areas around AI that are applicable to different sectors, whether it's in the health sector or, you know, the planning departments. I mean, we've got, you know, 39 separate departments. So it's got, the use and application of AI will vary depending on, you know, where and how. But that'll actually enable the government and the public service to be a lot more efficient and streamlined. But, I mean, this is also, again, this is, we're talking about a 2% reduction in year one and then a 5% the following years. So it's still quite a, it'll still be quite a, you know, a proportionate shift. It's not going to be a radical shift, so people have time to adjust, and those areas that get exposed will have, I guess, you know, a runway or a timeline in terms of where and how and who it might affect. But the other thing, of course, is, you know, traditionally New Zealand's operated at public service at about a 1% of population, and we've seen the increase now from 47,000 to about 63,000 to a 1.2% increase. So all we're saying is, despite saying we're going to try and achieve efficiency, use AI. We're actually just trying to bring it back to what has been a long-standing baseline at 1%.
And I mean, you've kind of touched on it there with kind of the increased rollout of this usage. But is AI usage likely to be something that the National Party supports going forward in the government?
Oh, very much. I think AI usage is going to be one of those things, you know, excuse me, in a couple of years' time, it's like saying, oh, who doesn't use the internet? I guess it is a dynamic space, and obviously, you know, what those boundaries, where those boundaries start and stop is still, you know, anybody's guess. But I think it would be silly not to use. I mean, there's obviously it can be used. You can get things like programming done that's very specific to your need. But I'm sure there'll be a lot of off-the-shelf applications that we could use in different, you know, portfolio sectors right now that might help around logistics or planning or, you know, efficiencies with managing inquiry, whether they be on phone or, you know, through the internet. So there'll be a raft of changes, I think, and it's about getting it, you know, courses for courses and ensuring that I don't think there'll be one overarching AI application. I think it'll be just finding those nuances and those applications and where they're best fit. And obviously that won't be static either. I mean, that'll be, you know, it's such a constant evolution, so.
And with that said, where does the government stand now on the need for AI safety and regulation bodies, especially when thinking about potential vulnerabilities and, you know, rolling this out in the government?
Well, I think it's, again, like, I think it's happened so fast. I think it's always something that we'll be watching and obviously watching other jurisdictions as well. I mean, certainly, you know, deep fake is one element of it that we've got legislation, you know, in the House at the moment that's getting worked through, as well as our sort of broader social media policy remit. So that's I guess a part of it. I mean, it's not, you wouldn't say social media is AI, but the algorithms behind it no doubt would be AI. So it's going to be very iterative, but I guess we can't also let us stop using it, you know, and get left behind.
Last week also saw the first reading of a bill determined to define gender. What is National's aim in supporting this bill?
Yeah, I mean, this is quite a hot topic and, you know, it can be quite sensitive for some people. At this stage, we thought the best thing we can do is let's send it off to select committee where it can get tested and thrashed around and community and stakeholders that, you know, are particularly passionate about it can have their say. And you know, we'll keep an open mind and see where that goes. I think people have to be aware that this isn't going to, this isn't a silver bullet. I mean, you know, some people talk about, they get into the intricacies of men and women in sport and transgender sports and that sort of thing. I'm not sure that this bill will address those things, but it will certainly, it will certainly attract those conversations and, we feel it's a conversation New Zealanders want to have. So we'll see how it goes as it progresses.
I mean, you've kind of said it there, but why is this something that right now the government is looking at kind of tackling?
Well, I think we wouldn't. We wouldn't have made it a priority, but it's a members' bill. And obviously, you know, that's one of those, I guess, you know, quirks of Parliament where any person from any party gets to draw something out, and this is one of those ones, and so therefore we have to take a position on it. That some people are lucky, like Catherine Webb. I think she's drawn her third members' bill in 2 years, which I'd imagine is probably a parliamentary record, because I've known MPs that have been in the House for 12 years and haven't drawn one. That's one of those, I guess it's essentially a lottery, and once they get drawn, parties have to, you know, test them. And you know, even the members' bills we've seen today, it's drawn a mixed response from all parties across the House.
And with this bill, what does the government say to accusations or criticisms of potential transphobia from the government?
No, I mean, I don't think this bill is going to address all those concerns. I mean, it's fairly defined in terms of what its scope is. So some of that stuff may fall outside of the scope. Some of it might come through in submissions. I guess ultimately what we want to see is clarity from the New Zealand public on is this an appropriate vehicle to take forward, or is it too narrow? So I guess that will all get flushed out through Select Committee.
Moving onwards, the government has rolled out their rebranding of government agencies to putting the English names first again. Why is this something that the national government saw as needed?
This was actually something we had as part of the coalition arrangement, and I guess we're into that sort of final stretch now and ensuring that we're honouring things that we committed to, you know, whether it was with us in ACT or us in New Zealand First. And this was something that hadn't been finalised. So essentially, it's a commitment that we made that we needed to see through.
That was National Party MP Ryan Hamilton on the government's AI usage, the legislation, definitions of Women and Man Amendment Bill, and the government changing government agencies' names to give primacy to the English.
That was our weekly chat with National MP Ryan Hamilton.
We'll be right back. Text in 5395 with any of your thoughts on these pieces.
She was born there. She grew up out in the Hutt Valley. Then she left home looking for something. She thought she'd find it in a city. She'd go dancing in the weekends. Her friends were starting up new bands. Tight black dresses and hairspray. Talking about tomorrow night. About 8 o'clock tomorrow night, when the town starts filling up. Tomorrow night, about the time that the pubs start jumping and the drunks start fighting, we'll start dancing. She went to London to find work there, claim her colonial birthright. Cleaning hotel rooms in the mother country while people trudge to work in the dim light. Yeah. She'd go dancing in the nightclubs on the underground she'd ride. Talking loud in a Kiwi accent. Talking about tomorrow night. About 8 o'clock starts filling up. Tomorrow night, about the time that the pubs start jumping and the band starts playing. La 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 la, we'll start dancing. La 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 la, we'll start dancing. We'll start dancing. In the harbour, Oriental Bay, standing there in the sunlight, and they're playing a tape for the landing speed. Bunny bowed like a bird on the wing, onward the sailors cry.
No, she didn't want to stay there, she's on her flight. She'll be standing on the same ground as we are.
Ha! Tomorrow night. Tomorrow night, or when the town starts filling up. Tomorrow night, about the time that the pubs start jumping and the band starts playing. La 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 la, we'll start dancing. La 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 la, we'll start dancing. Tomorrow night, about the time that the pubs start jumping and the drunks start fighting, we'll start dancing.
Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. That was Tomorrow Night by The Front Lawn.
What's this button do? Whoa!
You are now entering the green world.
Last week, the United Nations General Assembly voted to pass a resolution that adopted the International Court of Justice's opinion last year that countries have an obligation to protect the environment from greenhouse gases. While New Zealand voted for the resolution, it did not co-sponsor it, a step back from 2023, when the country co-sponsored Vanuatu's original resolution to the International Court of Justice. This change in global position and the current government's recent proposal to ban taking corporations to court over greenhouse emissions have raised questions about whether the country is backsliding as an environmental leader. To discuss the UN resolution and New Zealand's position on the issue, producer Thomas talked to University of Waikato Associate Law Professor Nathan Cooper.
Now, how important is this newly passed UN resolution and what global impacts could it have?
From a sort of a political or a signalling point of view, then the General Assembly resolution is important. It sort of puts the seal of approval on last year's ICJ advisory opinion. So it's the kind of the first time where globally we've seen that kind of acknowledgement that the advisory opinion is the state of the art on state responsibility. It's an authoritative assertion of what states have got to do in response to climate change. But from a legal point of view, actually what the resolution didn't do was create any new obligations. It didn't change any obligations that weren't already there as a result of last year's advisory opinion. So politically or symbolically important, but legally hasn't changed anything.
And New Zealand did vote for this resolution, but we chose not to co-sponsor it, unlike the original resolution 2023. Was this a missed opportunity to step up as, you know, the global environmental leaders we like to think of ourselves as?
Absolutely. In my opinion, it was. In fact, I think it was really unfortunate. Not only did New Zealand sort of decide to miss that opportunity or turn down the opportunity to co-sponsor the resolution, but also, I mean, right until the 11th hour, right until close to the vote, the government chose not even to confirm that they would support the resolution itself. So I think that really is quite a significant signal that the government did not want to be seen at the forefront or at the vanguard of that resolution. Sure, they voted in favour in the end, and that's a mercy. Only a very small number of countries voted against, and certainly the government didn't do that. But it is a really sad indictment of quite a change in direction on the part of our government from being really heavily involved and signalling that we need to be taking climate change very seriously to doing something quite a lot less serious and quite a lot less swift. If you compare that to the resolution that in 2023 asked the International Court of Justice to prepare the advisory opinion, then New Zealand really was at the forefront of supporting its Pacific Island neighbours as co-sponsoring the resolution, and was really sort of quite vocal about the importance of that advisory opinion and the importance that the New Zealand government was taking to the resolution. So quite a significant change in just 3 years.
Does it feel like we're letting down our Pacific neighbours in that regard then, especially as, you know, we like to portray ourselves as that leader in the space?
Well, that's right. So for quite a while now, New Zealand has enjoyed that perception, that public perception, that status, if you like, as being something of a regional leader and an advocate for climate change response, particularly in the Pacific. And I think to have stepped away from that really does send a negative message to countries like Vanuatu and to Samoa and to Fiji and to other countries that are really at the forefront of bearing the brunt of climate change. But I think it goes beyond that as well. I mean, as people living in New Zealand, we are ourselves experiencing the consequences of climate change. So it's not even just a solidarity issue with our regional neighbours. It is a question of self-preservation as well. I mean, it really does make sense to take climate change seriously for the health and the thriving of our own country, not just our neighbours.
And talking about some of that reductive government action, you know, despite voting for the resolution, New Zealand's current domestic actions do seem a bit hypocritical. The government announced last week its intent to stop businesses from being able to be sued over greenhouse gas emissions. Why is the government so inconsistent here on this issue?
Yeah, well, I think certainly that announcement to make it difficult or impossible for private companies to be held accountable for the consequences of their greenhouse gas emissions is just one recent step away from being climate leaders. So whilst there may be sort of instances of inconsistency, I would actually say that over the last couple of years there's been quite a consistent move towards the government turning its back on some of its previous record or the previous record of other administrations as being at the forefront of appropriate climate change response. So if we put that decision in the context, for instance, of the overturning of the ban on offshore oil and gas exploration, so the potential to open up new reserves for fossil fuels, Fast Track Approvals Act to make it much more easy to expand mining, for instance, mining of metallurgical coal and other minerals. You know, there's been a number of different policy and law changes over the last couple of years, led by the coalition government, that really do sit very uncomfortably with what the ICJ's advisory opinion says are the obligations of states. So maybe not so much hypocritical and maybe just quite a clear and clearly different direction of travel in this coalition government than we'd seen in previous administrations.
From a slightly more hopeful lens, what actions would you like to see the government take in response to this resolution being passed?
Well, for me, the number one thing is now to look again at the law and policy settings around climate change and state responsibility to climate change, in light of the fact that this government has just voted in favour of the resolution. In other words, the resolution has been agreed with, approved of by our government. If we now look at the content of the ICJ's advisory opinion, it's clear within that advisory opinion that actions like increasing fossil fuel production, granting fossil fuel exploration licenses, granting fossil fuel subsidies, these are all very likely to be internationally wrongful acts as per the advisory opinion. So what I would like to see the government doing is to rethink or look again at some of their recent changes in those areas and to actually start taking the content of the advisory opinion seriously now that they've voted for it.
That was the University of Waikato's Associate Professor Nathan Cooper speaking about the United Nations climate resolution that states have a legal obligation to tackle the climate crisis.
That was The Green World.
I got a dream. Don't we all? I can fly. Not a cloud in the sky, no sign of pain, no chance of lies. I'm not gonna ever let it go. It's the only dream I know. I got a dream, like I gotta breathe. I'm on my way to the maple leaf. Keep on dreaming night and day.
till the Sandman comes my way. I'm not gonna ever let it go. It's the only dream I know. So why is it so damn hard to make a dream come true? Some shooting stars, but that ain't all I gotta do. Been washed out at sea, serenading lady luck. Been down on my knees, yeah, but I'm not giving up. No, I can't leave a dream if you know. Put them 6 feet in the deep. They gon' find me in my sleep and turn my world upside down. 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 Upside down.
That was The Only Dream I Know by Brett McKenzie.
Ooh!
The Wire.
In just over 2 weeks' time, the FIFA World Cup is set to begin across North America. This comes, however, in the face of increasing heats due to climate change that could threaten the well-being of players and fans and force the game and competition to change. This is rather complicated, however, when we look at the role that FIFA and the competition themselves play in climate change, with serious concerns of greenwashing and sportswashing. With World Cups being high-emission events, and FIFA President Gianni Infantino maintaining ties with leaders such as US President Donald Trump, who often antagonizes attempts to reduce climate change. I spoke with professional teaching fellow at the University of Auckland, Dr. Chris McMillan, about how this temperature will affect athletes and the role the competition and FIFA have to play. Could you explain the issues around temperature that athletes will be facing at the upcoming World Cup?
Yeah, there's a range of issues there around both extreme temperatures, but also extreme weather in general. And it's difficult to put one conclusion around it because the tournament's been held across three different countries in a number of different kind of environments. So what you might get in Canada could be quite different to southerly regions in the US or in Mexico. But we're looking at research suggests around about a quarter of games could exceed heat safety limits, which is, you know, there was a World Cup played in 1994 in the US, but the risk has sort of extreme temperatures has doubled by some estimates since that time. So what we're seeing is a real risk to athletes for heat stress, but that risk also extends to fans and to workers as well, who both of them might be more at risk or less more exposed to extreme heat.
And when we're looking at that heat stress, especially when comparing to, you know, past World Cups, what does this kind of say about the health and well-being of players, both at this World Cup and going forward?
Yeah, I think the FIFA Players Union have been quite forthright on this. They think there's a real threat to players who aren't being taken seriously here. So around about a quarter of games could exceed sort of heat safety limits, particularly when we're looking at what they call wet bulb globe temperature, which is a measure of heat stress that combines humidity and heat. And essentially, it's when you're looking at the point where the body loses its ability to cool itself down, putting players under heat stress, particularly when we look at heat stress is not just high temperatures, but high humidity as well. And once that gets really high and players stop losing the ability to cool themselves down, then they really are in danger. And while FIFA's put a couple of measures in with 3 minute cooling breaks at sort of quarter time and three quarter time, the players are really suggesting that not only could they experience health risks, but also that perhaps it will just slow the game down. Not only are you having these breaks, but players become more dehydrated and more sluggish. It makes it harder for them to recover. So even coaches are looking at ways in which they prepare players for these conditions. I think the English men's coach was looking at installing saunas at players' houses. And in terms of the future, sometimes climate change and climate change in sport is looked at as something that might happen here. But we're really looking at the future in action. And while North America might be a particular site of heat risk, I think we're seeing more and more tournaments that are being affected by heat. And we're starting to have to think about ways in which players can adapt, but also tournaments can adapt. And in terms of football, it might be that we're seeing the end of Summer World Cups.
I mean, building on that, right, when we think about the way that, you know, the sport now has to turn and face with climate change, what does this kind of say about the way that typically maybe the public might see, like you said, climate change in sport as a thing of the future? What does it say about the way that they're interfacing right now?
Yeah, I think the World Cup's going to be a shock for a lot of people, because in the background, scientists and advocates have been raising this issue. But it's a whole different thing when you're watching a football game that's actually being delayed effectively by climate change and seeing players collapse perhaps because of climate change. And there we sort of see sport as one of those ways in which we meet climate change in a more material accessible kind of way. That when you see your sports clubs, sporting facilities flooding, or it's just too hot to play, you really are experiencing climate change on the front lines in ways in which you might not otherwise. And so I think what a lot of fans are going to experience, and it's of course unpredictable, but if we look back at the 2025 Club World Cup held in the US last year, there are a number of long delays, some leading up to 2 hours, both because of extreme heat, but also threats of thunder or storms. So the viewing experience of the World Cup could be really quite different this time.
And of course, you touched on it before, but a big player in all of this is, of course, FIFA specifically. Mm. What kind of policy and stance on climate does FIFA currently have, and how is that kind of affecting where we're at now?
So we've got two kind of directions there. One is the way in which FIFA is immediately responding to changing conditions and putting in cooling breaks, which many would suggest are insufficient to actually cool the body. In terms of environmental sustainability, FIFA does kind of talk a big game about identifying a climate emergency and reducing emissions. But this tournament is predicted to generate the most emissions of any global sporting event, well beyond the last one in Qatar in 2022. And that's because of the amount of travel that fans will have to will do to get to North America and travel within the continent, but also because the tournament keeps expanding. We're up to 48 teams, which means more fans and more travel. Now, it could be because of sort of the geopolitics and the Trump White House that fewer fans travel. But I think the contradiction is the more successful the tournament is for organizers, as in the more fans arrive, the more emissions it creates, so the more environmentally damaging the tournament is.
And kind of expanding the role of FIFA here, what we've seen over the last couple of years, especially with the last World Cup in Qatar, and now this World Cup with Gianni Infantino interfacing directly with US President Donald Trump. US President Trump has, you know, a history of not being super on board with a lot of responses to the climate crisis. What does it kind of say that the sporting body is interfacing with this kind of politics in the face of these health problems?
Yes, you can see FIFA, you know, if you look up their website and their policies, they do, as I say, talk a big game about climate change. They say that they're taking it seriously. But their approach really does sort of speak to what climate denial often looks like now, where organizations talk about taking climate change seriously, but then their actions suggest almost the opposite. And as I was mentioning before, these tournaments keep expanding. The next one's across three different continents and six Nations, but also in 2024, FIFA signed a partnership with Aramco, the Saudi oil giant, and the 2034 tournament will be in Saudi Arabia. As you mentioned, the US administration's has rolled back a number of climate change initiatives. So what we're seeing is their actions, both in how they plan tournaments, but also the organizations that they're investing in, perhaps take an entirely different angle to what they're talking about when it comes to climate change.
So then if we're looking at kind of FIFA as maybe a body that's doing either sports washing or greenwashing, how does this kind of What image does this kind of paint about the role of football going forward? Is this just the way that it's going to be with heat, or can we expect to see any sort of change or progress?
I think we've got a couple of things here. If the question is this just going to be the way it is with heat? Yes, and worse. I think we're going to see more and more tournaments being impacted by heat stress. And perhaps more importantly, while top athletes might be able to deal with this kind of heat, that's not the majority of football or majority of sport, which is played by amateurs and recreational facilities that don't have shade or roofs and aren't able to take regular hydration breaks in the same way. In terms of how sports address climate change, I think the irony is, and it's a cruel one, that the more we've seen climate change take an effect, the more climate change action and discourse seems to be fading away. In that previous tournaments have had quite substantial environmental policy around them, whereas this one and the Club World Cup, there's very little. Most of the sort of policy and responsibilities is passed on to host cities, despite them having very little control over the environmental impact of the tournament. I think, to give you a short sort of soundbite, the All Whites are playing Iran on June 16th at 1 p.m. in LA, and that game in particular, because it's played in LA and during the afternoon, might be particularly difficult. And there's also the risk of wildfires as well in the background. So a lot of this is weather is unpredictable, even if we know that the climate is changing. But I think some people could be quite shocked by the weather conditions and how disruptive they are. And I think it's important that we see that this isn't just an aberration, but this is more of what the future of sport will be. Moreover, that the massive environmental impact of the tournament, quite possibly, obviously it depends on fan behavior, but quite possibly the most polluting sports event in history, isn't an accident. It isn't just a matter of poor design. Instead, it's how the tournament is designed. You get fans to fly in from all the way around the world. You treat it as a tourist event. Obviously, carbon emissions are going to be very, very high. If the World Cup keeps expanding, if it keeps having more teams, more matches played in more places, then that environmental impact is just going to increase. While at the same time, we're seeing games being impacted by these climate changes.
That was the University of Auckland's Chris McMillan on climate change-based temperature threats to those at the FIFA World Cup and what it means for FIFA and football.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki. Nei te mihi ki a rātou I kōrero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Tuesday Wire. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. Professor Alan Blackman, National MP Ryan Hamilton, the University of Waikato's Nathan Cooper, and University of Auckland's Chris McMillan. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up, we've got the 1-4 with Jin.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.